Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
But now, Griffin Dunn, good morning.
Good morning.
You're very welcome.
Oh, it's good to get caught up on the news.
Now, Griffin, people will know you as an actor, an American Werewolf in London, Who's That Girl, even with Madonna, and then Scorsese's great underrated After Hours, films like that. But you've written a memoir, mm-hmm. and you call it a family memoir. And it's some family and it's some story. There are feuds, terrible tragedy. It involves everyone from Carrie Fisher, Truman Capote's in there, your aunt, Joan Didion, who people will know, the Year of Magical Thinking and a lot of her other work. You do know, don't you, that the book, this is a classic dysfunctional Irish family story. You just happen to be in Hollywood with loads of famous people around.
It just happened to be. Well, you know, my family, the Duns and the Burns, are originally from Roscarron. That's where my great grandfather came over and settled in West Hartford. That's where our sense of humor, when things are absolutely terrible, as they have been in the course of our lives, with my mother's health, and we faced a tragedy, the violent death of my sister, and all sorts of things. We've always rebounded with this. We're all really funny, and we just keep rebounding, and we've always accredited our Irish background for that.
So you grew up in the heart of La La Land, really. So the Hollywood people around the house all the time. So tell me about your father, Dominic. People will remember Dominic Dunn. But tell me about his Hollywood parties at that stage of life and his desperation for acceptance by these people.
You know, he put so much value on Hollywood celebrity and the famous people that would come to his parties. And, you know, he was a big movie fan as a child. He was very charming, and my mother was very, very beautiful. And they were like they were the it Hollywood couple. We're talking about in the 60s, from 1960 to 66, until they divorced. And they gave, one of the parties that they gave was a legendary party called the Black and White Ball. And it went on all night long. My father took out all the furniture from our house and had set designers do the entire house to look like the Ascot Ball from My Fair Lady. And people arrived in, you know, black and white. And there was a young Dennis Hopper, and then there was David Niven, and there were the great filmmakers like Billy Wilder, and Truman Capote came, he brought Detective Dewey, who solved the In Cold Blood case in Kansas.
Yeah.
That was when Truman was most famous, and he brought along that detective. And it was in all the papers. It started, you know, at 7, and it went till 6 the next morning. They served eggs to all the guests, you know, on trolleys, you know, eggs and Bloody Marys at 6 in the morning so they can keep dancing. John Huston and William Wyler, the great director, they got into a fist fight in our front lawn, broken up by the police, who were sent the night before crates of champagne so that they would, you know, give them grace on going late into the night. They also sent champagne to all their neighboring friends, you know, all the neighbors.
Yeah.
So it was a legendary ball and terribly important, the highlight of my father's success as a social climber. And Truman Capote gave the next year a black and white ball.
Yeah, which became, of course, a very
And guess
very
who
famous.
Didn't invite? My dad.
Okay.
He never invited him.
I sense from the book that even as a kid, you found your father's kind of social climbing embarrassing. So he was working as a kind of a producer at this
stage. Yeah, he was a television producer, which is also a mystery that television and movies at that time never overlapped. But still, he had great charisma or I don't know, desperation, actually, to bring to bring these people into his life. And this is I'm describing him, you know, as a young father and a young husband, because he was an evolving character, and he became something very different toward the end of his life.
Absolutely, and that's probably how a lot of people would remember him as Donald. That's how he should be remembered, in a way, the modern true crime kind of genre.
Exactly.
Dennis Hopper, you mentioned at the party, he mentioned years later how embarrassing it all was, didn't he?
Yeah, it was. My father, this is his most insecure period of his life, would trot us down, my brother, sister, and I, in matching bathrobes to see all the guests, who were by this time already drunk. And we would say goodnight, and then we would bow, the boys would bow, and my sister would curtsy and jam a little Victorian nightcap. And the grown-ups go, ooh and ah and ooh and ah. And Dennis Hopper and he and I were smoking a joint years and years later, making a movie. And he said, man, when your father trotted you guys down the steps to say goodnight, I thought that was the saddest thing I ever saw.
So
killed
then,
my high.
As you say, that was one phase of him.
Yes,
and
it was.
And then before he had, you know, that his golden kind of redemption, so he lost everything then. Your mother had enough of the kind of, I think, the social climbing, among other things.
He also
got cast out of Hollywood.
He did, indeed. He, he had a drinking problem. He stopped from being, you know, sort of a fun drunk to kind of a mean drunk, and he would be kind of a gossip about very powerful people. And then one day, the most powerful agent in Hollywood, a woman named Sue Mingers, he was drunk and made a joke. She was very, very, very obese, and he made a fat joke about her, and it was put in the paper, and he was over.
Just like that.
All the studios just got together, and he was in the middle of making a picture with Elizabeth Taylor called Ash Wednesday, which was not very good and well over budget. And they said, pack your bags, you're out of there. And he never worked again.
Now, your dad was also gay, but
hiding it from everybody. Yeah.
Was he successfully hiding it from the family, from his wife?
I think it was the worst kept secret in the world.
Okay.
We just didn't really talk about it very much. He didn't bring it up, so we didn't bring it up. I didn't find it. We grew up as children. Our parents had couples who were gay couples all the time, so it was never an issue. But I think it was for him to not be more for after the divorce. He could have done it as, and it wouldn't have made any difference. But you know, when he was growing up, he wasn't wildly masculine. His brothers all were; they were all athletes, and he was putting up pictures of Tyrone Power and Betty Davis and his room, and his father called him, you know, would call him a sissy and beat him with a belt. And I think, he was filled with shame. And it was a Catholic family, and he, you know, from an early age, he was probably, you know, feeling these attractions for the same sex. And I think that embedded shame just carried on through, even though he fooled no one, you know, as he got older. Mm-hmm. He didn't go out of his way to fool, but there was just something about it, you didn't want to even really broach it.
Now, do you mind telling me the story about it? When you kind of first met one of your father's lovers, who he said at the time was his valet, was his bizarre
yes.
cover story, you had a kind of a strange reaction to it. Do you mind telling me about that?
No. I walked in. I was going out with a girl who was very, very beautiful, but also a little mean. And we walked in on my father and this young man, and the guy wasn't wearing a shirt, and that was weird. And then he came down and he was wearing a shirt, and Dad said, oh, this is my valet, I just heard, which was absurd. And, it was very clear what happened, what this relationship was. And so this girl said, oh, as we're walking away, goes, Griffin, your father, he likes men. He likes, you know, everything in there. If he likes men, do you think your father, do you think the son likes men? Do you think you do? And I went, it never occurred to me. But then I suddenly got it in my head, you know, is this contagious? Do I have the gay gene? Do I, you know, I'm 17, by the way. And I was kind of worried about that. And I wanted to be an actor. And if you were outwardly gay, in the business at that time, you only played gay people, and lucky at that. And so I was kind of worried about that. And so I went over. My father went out of town. The valet stayed there. I can't believe I'm saying this on Irish television. And so I swung by just to find out. Got a little something going, and the guy said, listen, I got to tell you, Griffin, you haven't got what it takes to be a homo.
Okay. So when you were young, a teenager, Carrie Fisher was actually your best friend probably at that
point.
Oh,
without a doubt, he was my best friend.
I think I get the sense, you don't say this, but I get the sense you fell in love with her pretty much at first sight, but it was a mostly platonic.
It was platonic, but just about every man fell in love with her at first sight. And when we were best friends, every time we met a guy, this guy would fall in love. And then he'd go through me to find out, you know, how do I get her to be falling in love with me? You know, it was I was really like the guard at the gate.
What was it about her?
She was the funniest person. She was so filled with life and had such imagination. And the words and the combination of sentences were like poetry that just came out of her. And then she could burst into song. And, you know, you just followed her. You just wanted to know where this was all going.
Just extraordinary charisma. Yeah. She didn't think much of Star Wars.
No, well,
When it was being made,
She would call me in New York and go, oh my God, Griffin, this movie is such a turkey. I wear two bagels on my head. I've got this 12-foot chimp follows us down hallway, you know, we're running and there's this, they have a little British actor and they put him in a trash can and he rolls alongside of us. And he goes, oh, this is going to be the biggest turkey ever. What's it called? I said, what's that movie? Is that two words, Star Wars? No, it's Star and then it's Wars.
Yeah.
It was Star Wars.
Yeah, who would have said? Interesting then, when you saw her getting famous, I think it unsettled your relationship with her, and it also kind of made you weird about fame as well, did it?
Absolutely. It was so, it's an interesting dynamic when, you know, we have two people who are, you know, struggling actors, you have all that in common, and then one of you just becomes globally famous, like overnight, and you're watching all this change happened, not just in your relationship, but people the way they are toward your friend, and by contrast to you. And you know, even we were in a building that had when we were roommates, we had a doorman who we loved named Eddie, and we'd always know about Eddie and how's your kids and blah blah blah. And then about a week after the movie opens, I see Eddie and he goes, "Good morning, Mr. Fisher." I'm like, what? And then all these the rock stars and the movie stars of that I grew up, you know, loving and buying their albums and seeing their movies, they were all in our living room. But they were for her, you know. Yeah. And I was a waiter. I was still waiting on tables, counting my tips, you know, with Carly Simon and James Taylor in my bedroom. You know?
Yes. But no, your acting career did take off then. I suppose An American Werewolf in London was kind of your big break. But listen, tell me about After Hours, which I think for a lot of people, it is in a quiet way one of people's favorite movies. It's a kind of a slightly underrated, maybe, as Scorsese film.
It took a while
film,
to take out. Yeah. It's now really
but it is
appreciated.
It's a magic film. So Tim Burton, who's actually, he's down in Wicklow at the moment.
I know he's shooting here.
Yeah, so he was to make it.
Yeah.
When he was starting
well,
out.
Well, first we went to Martin Scorsese. My partner, Amy Robinson, was in the movie Mean Streets, one of Marty's first movies. And so she knew he had that sense of humor and the ability to appreciate the absurd. So we went to him first, but he was off to shoot Last Temptation of Christ, and his with Aidan Quinn it was going to be, and But he'd made King of Comedy. It lost the studio a lot of money. The Paramount at that time felt that this movie, Last Temptation, was going to be over budget, and they pulled the plug. We didn't know that would happen. We were already, when we knew he wasn't available, we went and saw a film called Vincent. It was a short film that came before another Disney movie. And we went, who made that? And it was, it didn't have actors, but it was, there was something brilliant about it. It was an animated about a little boy who wanted to be Vincent Price, narrated by Vincent Price. And so we tracked him down. It was Tim Burton. He was working in the animation department at Disney. And you could tell immediately, we'd send him the script, and you could tell immediately this guy was really something. And he had little drawings of what Paul Hackett, my character, would look like, which was oddly like Edward Scissorhands.
Okay.
And, you know, walking down hallways and bats kind of in the background. And then Marty gets the plug pulled on Last Temptation. And during this time, we had a hard time raising money. He hadn't not only directed a feature, he hadn't directed a human being. And I wasn't a star of any kind. So we were a tough package to begin with. And then when Marty came back after being let go of Last Temptation and having the movie shut down, this was on the top of his pile. And he called up and said, what's the story? So we had that uncomfortable thing to, we started to tell Tim what had happened, who he knew. We went to Marty first. And he went, wait, are you saying that Mr. Scorsese wants to make this film? Okay. Well, you know, yes. But we haven't said no. And I respectfully withdraw from your project. I'll never do anything to get in the way of what he wants to do.
Yeah, what a class act.
So the next time he got hired, we weren't worried about him. About a month later, he was hired to do Pee-wee's Big Adventure. That came out and kicked our ass in the box office.
Yeah, he made the right choice in the end. So listen, then after, following After Hours, right, you turned down The Fly, you turned down Sex, Lies and Videotape. Was it that aversion to fame? Was it a kind of self-sabotage?
Yeah, I was trying to describe a combination of things, of the bouillabaisse of anxieties about, one, about fame and that kind of attention. And I think, you know, it had to play with the importance of when I was growing up in my father's eyes, so which struck me as uncomfortable and made me a little superficial. I thought him superficial. I'd also seen the business that he loved just destroy him as I was coming into it. And also, quite honestly, I just was not very good at knowing what was best for me as an actor. I didn't have that wherewithal that some actors who are movie stars that for 20, 30 years, they can really be like the CEOs of their own career, you know? But I was good at story. I was good at producing and directing and knowing a good script or seeing what would be a good movie if I saw it in a movie, you know, in a magazine article or a newspaper or a book. But as far as having the wherewithal and the insight about my own destiny, that wasn't my strong suit as an actor.
We mentioned tragedy. It must have been very hard to revisit, and you do it very comprehensively in the book, the murder of your sister Dominique. She was just 22, and she was killed by her boyfriend. Tell me about that.
Well, you know, she was a actress just at the beginning of her career, and she. Unlike me, she became successful right away. As soon as she told me she wanted to be an actress, she was on a soundstage in a lead role like a month later. And both of our movie debuts were in horror films. She was in Poltergeist and mine being American Werewolf in London. They came out around the same time. And we always had this, you know, sort of fantasy of being a sibling acting couple that would go on. And as her career rose quite rapidly, she had a boyfriend that was a sous chef at a restaurant. And as she became more successful, he was that kind of person that becomes very threatened by success and her, you know, she just had such charisma and everybody loved her and he was a big threatening oaf. But no one knew that he had a violent past. And in fact, so he did attack her once and tried to strangle her. She escaped. Kicked him out of the house, changed the locks, put all his luggage out on the front lawn, and some months later, on October Eve, he came back to her house and got her to come outside, and he strangled her to death. Well, not to death. She was on life support for 5 days, and. And everything, and when I write this in the book, I know I'm coming up to this. It's been, you know, it's been really fun. And, you know, as I'm going through everyone's childhood and Dominique being born and all the animals that she had in her career. But when I got to this, the book takes a very different turn because our lives, our family was never the same. Mm. You know, that was, and I said, this is part two. And when part two happened, everything that could have gone wrong did go wrong. From going to see, when we take her off life support and going to see the Monsignor that had christened us, my sister and brother and I, he was drunk when we went to go see him, and he booked her funeral and a wedding at the same day, at the same time. And so we're bringing up the casket as the brides are coming down. Everything went crazy. And then we had a trial, and it got even worse. And this judge took such a dislike on sight, inexplicably, to our family, and withheld from the jury testimony that we saw of a woman that he had gone out with before the killer, and had hospitalized twice. They missed that. They missed a violent outburst of the killer in the courtroom because he was upset about the testimony. And the judge said, we're so sorry, Mr. Sweeney, that was his name. We know this must be so hard for you. And as a result, they just thought he was just a little boy who broke his heart, had his heart broken, and he served 3.5 years.
That the trial sounds in a way as traumatizing as Dominique's
without a doubt, yes, and it
but then there was a very strange outcome of it, which was that for your father, who had been cast out, and but I think he had come back to Hollywood, hadn't he? Truman Capote had said not to Hollywood.
He came back to New York, never to the movie business. Yeah. But he came back. He had gotten sober, and he lived in a tiny apartment in New York, which, you know, years earlier you couldn't have imagined being in such a place. And he was no longer materialistic, and he was quite spiritual, and he an incredible birth of spirit.
So he met Tina Brown.
And he met Tina
Vanity
Brown.
Fair.
And she said, she was just starting Vanity Fair, and the night before he went to Los Angeles for the trial, he had dinner with her. He'd never met her before. And he described her to me as going, this woman saw me. She saw me as a writer. And she told him, if you write what your family's going to go through in this trial, I will publish it. And he wrote something that was extraordinary, that described our journey through hell and facing what many families will feel and face particularly if they have a daughter that was murdered in the system, of how a woman, if she's raped or killed, how they blame her for her outcome. And it was a very powerful piece. And at great cost, after everything Dad has been through, he finds his voice as a writer. He finds his purpose. And his purpose is, when he covers murder trials, as he did of O.J. and Phil Spector and the Menendez. He never let you forget about the victims in those cases, and which journalists did not do. They would focus on the, you know, our perverse attraction to the actual killer. But he would always remind you, you know, the that Nicole was somebody's daughter, that, you know, she had a life and was not just a victim. So it transformed him.
Yeah, yeah. And that is the Dominic Dunne that a lot of
that
us
is the Dominic Dunne
growing up.
Has.
Now, your dad's brother, also a writer, John Gregory Dunne, people will have heard of him, and his wife, Joan Didion.
Yep.
They left the country for the duration of the trial.
Yeah, it caused a great deal of tension between our two families. John Dunne, my uncle, was a brilliant crime reporter himself, and he knew all the players that would be involved in our trial. And, you know, he'd wandered up and down those hallways and in that courthouse, and he'd written many a crime story. He knew all the cops, and he knew just where this trial was going. And he did everything he could to behind the scenes to make a plea deal, so we would not have to go through what we went through, and was unsuccessful. And one of the things that he knew that they were going to drag Dominique, my sister, named through the mud and dig up whatever they could. And he had a daughter who was a little younger than Dominique, Quintana.
And people will remember Joan Didion's book, Blue Nights, an extraordinary book about Quintana.
Exactly. A very, very tough book. And Quintana died before her mother. And she had, as a teenager, she was a heavy partier, and it became a little more tragic, you know, as she got older. But even as a teenage partier and her association with Dominique, John and Joan were worried that Quintana would be called as a witness.
Okay. So they were protecting themselves
and their
family
daughter
and everything. But it did feed, didn't it? And this is classic Irish brother stuff. Your father, Dominic, and John. I think Dominic was jealous of John and Joan Didion anyway,
hatred. Yeah, it was a toxic, complicated relationship that might have even gone back to John not being beaten by his father and denying that Dad was ever beaten by their father.
Okay.
But also, when my father was riding high in Hollywood society, he brought John and Joan in, and they made a lot of contacts at the parties. And then when Dad lost everything, John and Joan became almost like an identical it couple, only of the 70s of Hollywood.
Yeah.
You know, so they would have, you know, Scorsese and De Palma and Paul Schrader, they would all come to their house, but it wasn't reciprocal. You know, that's how Dad felt. And these two men really hated each other for many, many years. And I loved them both. And I was always trying to, you know, bring them together. It would always blow up in my face.
And you had a great relationship with John and with Joan Didion particularly.
Absolutely. From the time I was, you know, a young teenager, they would always bring me to their house and I go to their parties, you know, and I loved them. They were like another set of parents to me.
There's a beautiful documentary. I think it's still on Netflix, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
The Center Will Not Hold, that you made with Joan towards the end of her life. Tell me about, what was the magic of her?
She saw life, world events, cultural events very differently than she would see them. She would write about, say, the Manson killings, or she would write about a very famous case called the Central Park Five that was very racially driven. Her take on these sort of events weren't immediately accepted at the time. They were kind of controversial, but then they were like, oh, she was so far ahead of the curve.
Clear-eyed.
So clear-eyed. Yeah. Oh, my God. And everybody else was caught up on the hysteria and whatever the last minute the news was that was the other person just said that was ad and fed. Hers was like calm and reassured. Yeah.
She was very cool, wasn't she? She was just the coolest of cool,
you know, yeah. The big glasses and then
yeah.
And her, she was cool. But I wanted to make the doc because she was also really, really funny. And I don't think there was ever any documented footage of seeing her laugh.
Yeah.
And you see her laugh quite a bit in this movie. And I wanted to show her, you know, what she was like, because people are fascinated by her. Like, what is she really like? And I think I was able to show that.
You did. It's well worth checking out, and some amazing moments in it. Your father and John, again, classic Irish brother style, they made up at
the
end.
How about this? You know, they both of them had heart attacks. And without knowing it, one day my father walks into his cardiologist's office and not knowing that John has the same cardiologist, and they hadn't seen each other. They hadn't talked in 10 years. And they're both sitting in the office to see the same doctor. And they grunt, and Dad toward each other, and Dad takes a magazine, and they both pretend to read their magazines. And then John or Dad, they look up. They go, what the hell are we doing? Yeah. What? Life is too... And they just roared with laughter. And they spoke on the phone every day until the end of John's life.
Yeah, listen, extraordinary stories. Are you watching your president?
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you make of it?
Well, I mean, that debate was the saddest or most painful thing I've ever seen. I'm at a loss. Everybody's talking about getting rid of him. I haven't seen a name that I'm even familiar with.
You've come across Trump down the years, haven't you?
I have. Well, I'm a New Yorker. He grew up. That site was in our eyeline from the moment I moved to New York. That man's face and attitude. He. When I was shooting, you mentioned, who's that girl? We were shooting in front of Trump Tower. And Madonna and I were, whenever there's, we were outdoors, there was always helicopters and photographers and everything everywhere. And Trump comes down and barges onto our set and then brings his own photographer and to have his picture taken with Madonna. And it was just, he was just loathsome. And, but there is a picture of me and Trump and Madonna.
Okay, but we know no, you were an unwilling
just
participant.
Just make sure I was in it involuntarily.
Yeah, important to get that out there. Okay, listen, The Friday Afternoon Club, a family memoir by Griffin Dunne, is published by Grove Press. Griffin Dunne, I enjoy that so much. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.